Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and today we're beginning the first part of a fascinating yet gruesome journey into the mind of one of America's most notorious psychopaths, Ed Gein, the Butcher of Plainfield, who inspired a plethora of evil characters from legendary horror franchises such as Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Norman Bates from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. The theme of emotionally stifled and disturbed young men remaining at home with their mothers, staunchly loyal forever, and not transcending to become fathers outside the confines of their childhood through vulnerability and subsequent growth demanded in the adult world beyond, is a prevalent and powerful element of the horror and thriller genres. That's because, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's the template for the Antichrist. In your personal evolution from a boy to a man, your physical growth should accompany equivalent emotional movement so that the person you see in the mirror, to the best of your ability, is consistent with the one living inside your mind in your internal life. Disunity between body and mind is the preeminent factor in creating a man-child, or Antichrist, as the pain of being a child within and waiting for a childhood that's never coming back to return, while growing older outside, creates a void. And in that ever-growing void, there is only darkness and your capacity for falling into it and disappearing when the pain and practicality of trying to span that gap between those oppositional realities becomes too much to bear. You can't be a man and a child. Instead, you become a man-child, and so Leatherface manifests that desperation of trying to look young or stay young by cutting the faces off pretty teens and wearing them as his own. It's speaking to the horror one endures by trying to remain a boy when having grown to be a man. By disguising his face with the renewable resource of other people's young faces, he can always hide in that place between boyhood and adulthood because he always maintains that look facially. If he does this, he can remain at home without having to grow emotionally. And that's what's being said by Leatherface being someone who doesn't speak, but only grunts and cries out like an animal. He is unwilling, or even unable, to convey the problem, and because of that, he manifests it in images for us. And it happens by way of sneaking up on victims to convey our ignorance of how other people like him are hurting inside. So the image projects that damage on the outside in the form of physical dismemberment and death instead of being torn apart emotionally and dying on the inside where no one sees it. It's simply an issue related to identity, an emotional identity crisis that's manifested in physical horror. So for Norman Bates in Psycho, who is also the man-child, when his mother dies and he can no longer pretend to be just a boy and must become the father, so to speak, in the outside world, the way he manifests, or more appropriately, manipulates a solution, is to indulge a psychosis that allows him to pretend to be her. If she still exists in his mind, and he has not only her corpse, but also dresses like her to take actions derived from her will, so to speak, he can remain that innocent boy on the verge of transcendence, like Leatherface, who never actually grows up. The point is this: holding on to the mother is indicative of not wanting, or even being unwilling or incapable of, becoming the father. So when Norman, loyal to his mother, finds himself without a mother or father, and knows it means he has to become a man, he can't face reality and grow. To cope, he creates a facade, and within, he pretends nothing has changed. And what we learn about that facade, or psychosis, is that her will always dominates his. What mother says goes, which clues us into a harrowing truth. Norman isn't following his desires. Instead, he's indulging mothers. What we can see from that, even just from a cursory look at the structure of logic that defines a cycle of abuse, is that the emotional wound driving these behaviors are particular to Norman, but derived from his mother. So we have to ask, what happened to her in her youth, or even just her past? What made her like that? More importantly, why did Norman become the victim of her twisted motivations that dictated loyalty to her, never leaving home, and certainly never giving his affection to any grown woman who might bear his child in a relationship outside the confines of childhood? The answer is always that someone is trying to convey what they suffered. They want you to understand them without words. So, we merely need to examine the behavior of Ed Gein's mother, specifically that which she erases from his life in her adulthood, to comprehend what she suffered in silence in her childhood that drove her to imprison her son. Of course, this isn't very difficult. If Norman is based on Ed, we understand that both Norman and Ed were trained to never leave home and have relations with other women, which leads to one very obvious exclusion: the father. If you never become the father, so to speak, a mentally ill person manifesting erasure of the abusive father from their past comes to bear. Except it doesn't work. It just creates a perpetually abusive cycle. Now, if we ask, why would one want to erase the memory of the father? We do the same. We ask, what is the conduit between Norman's or Ed's interactions with women and the result of potentially becoming the father? The answer is sex. And if she is corrupting his sexuality when placed in our emotional mirror, so to speak, manifesting her emotion to Ed's or Norman's reality of being taught to not approach women for sex, what does it subsequently tell us? That mom was sexually abused by her father, and by producing a child who neither lusts for women nor ever grows up, moves out, and takes a wife, what she is doing is manifesting a surrogate husband, aka father, who will not do any of the things the abusive father did to her. He will be considered good and pure, and by that token, must still be a child. That's the facade. But beneath that is something much more disturbing, which is a revenge narrative. In our universal narrative, of course, we are always trying to get even, because getting even is the singularity. You go from binary to singularity. So getting even is the idea. That means when manifested, revenge becomes that form. Again, let's reverse it in our mirror. She's denying her son outside the home with other women what the father enjoyed inside the home with her, so that the son understands her pain. And so, like we see in both the movie Psycho and the TV show Bates Motel, Norman is not simply loyal to mother in totality. He is at war with himself, and subsequently at war with her, over the right to his failed independence. Emotionally, it's the difference between letting go and holding on. So at the climax of Psycho, as Norman could never truly let go of the past and the facade he used to cope, it's forced by way of tragic fate, as his grip on the knife, never stronger, is released, and mother's clothing and a wig, symbolizing the facade, begin to shed to reveal the man-child hiding beneath. In our evolutionary narrative, the father, or God, or the singularity, is truly the combination of a man, woman, and child, but it's an emotional evolution at its foundation, leading to technological innovation. So to display how it's been corrupted into physicality, absent psychological movement through erasure or death instead of emotional growth, Norman, while trying to kill everyone to keep the secret, is a man-child who is dressed as a woman. He's accounting for all of those characters combined, even though it was not an emotional ascension. It's manifested in physicality. That emotional ascension is what is necessary to precipitate the technological ascension to follow. So when Norman is placed inside his cell at the end, there's a fly that keeps landing on his hand, yet he does nothing about it. It says he's refusing the growth necessary for evolution, and in this era, that particular evolution, even as it was in 1960 upon the first humans having traveled to space and Psycho being released, was flight. We are slowly but surely ascending from the Earth or Mother into space, and so beneath the superficial considerations apparent in the perceived plot and themes in the film, there lies an evolutionary context as well. Norman's refusal to leave the comfort of the mother, to the point of pretending, even after the mother is dead, is a metaphor in the form of a warning or talisman describing what happens to humanity if we don't take flight from Earth, if we don't leave the nest. And so, in society, specifically in the construction or design of human beings, we find intentional flaws related to such. There is only the story of transcendence, of becoming the father. There is nothing else. Therefore, in society, we get the window dressing of this story immersed in countless superficial narratives that seemingly have no relation on the surface, but tell the same tale with an intuitive rendering. In that light, boys failing to grow to men, as they are specifically failures of transcendence, become the backbone for every story, even if a woman is the protagonist, as women's evolution necessitates conversion in AI to find equality with men by technologically obliterating traditional gender norms that render a binary world non-binary in the aftermath. A key element involved is extraction of the womb, of course, and by extension, reproduction, which means the mother and child disappear, along with the father becoming one thing, or equal, but still embodied and moving toward our ultimate form of being the one together, disembodied as God. So in our societal ills, what we often find is the manifestation of this story. Norman Bates has a disembodied father, but in the manifested version, meaning by way of mortality rather than eternal by way of ascension. And then the mother and child, or son, characters, in the absence of the father, struggle with the reality of not having sex and reproducing to become the father. So Norman's emotional wound becomes one in which he can't grow up and become the father by traditional means, as the absence of his father and his mother's will forbids it. That means the struggle of Norman Bates is the struggle of today's man and woman, which is to learn how to become the father in the absence of reliance upon sex and reproduction to facilitate that growth. That's why you have multiple channels of perception, in terms of a conscious or rational mind being connected to an intuitive or unconscious or even unrealized mind by way of the subconscious. On the surface, the movie or crime story you indulge plays a superficial narrative that is consistent with your social understanding of the world, or that which you experience through images, and those images must produce symbolism consistent with the evolutionary or intuitive narrative that runs beneath that conscious rendering, like the unconscious mind, with the movie itself being the subconscious or projector of those ideas with symbolic images. So think of everything you see being in a binary context. You consume those symbolic images below the surface, so to speak, in your unconscious mind, absent of your explicit experience. And then conversely, the images on the screen also have social value currently that implore your rational understanding. You might ask, well, what good is this shit if I can't experience it explicitly? Like, if I don't know, what good is it? Why is it being hidden from me? Well, here's the answer. The narrative occurring intuitively below the surface and in relation to our evolution is not a lesson that can be considered and subsequently acted upon in terms of the totality of necessity for growth. So, for instance, at this time, as we are just starting the creation of the technology that will facilitate the reality of our ascension in the future from robotic humans to spacecraft, any type of explicit warning from nature about the consequences of failure puts the cart before the horse, so to speak. The evolutionary narrative lurking beneath the explicit narrative, or social facade, or social veil, in a film doesn't offer itself free of a veil because, like the unconscious mind, it deals in what is yet unrealized. It speaks to your brain irrationally through symbolism in a manner that allows you to be educated and motivated free of concern, as that which is current or on the screen in terms of social value necessitates your rational consideration now. So intellectually, everything in your rational mind, meaning everything you have already experienced in life, is inside your head, so to speak. You utilize recall to access that existing information. That means, for recall, you utilize a screen or mind's eye inside your head to project necessary imagery. But what you need to know next, or in the perpetual now, as it becomes realized in the moment, needs to be projected from your brain onto an exterior screen reflected at you, which could be your reality if it's a life problem, or even a movie screen if you're watching a film. Now, that which lies ahead, or in the future, is currently in darkness, or unrealized, in the unconscious mind. So what is currently playing on the screen not only acts as what you need to know on a superficial or social level, but beneath, symbolically, and on an evolutionary level, what you'll soon need to know in the future, so that when those images that were once only intuitive start to take on explicit meaning instead, their structure will mimic our process of realization that defines emotional growth, which is narrowing the gap between who we are and who we're supposed to become, or want and need. We could also say it's the difference between the self and unrealized self. The social narrative accommodates the ego, or who am I? And the evolutionary narrative accommodates the authentic self, or who am I becoming? So, in your mind, as you watch a film, and also as you experience the world through your eyes, the images you witness and consider rationally and in relation to today's social norms are about indulging the ego of embodiment, or who am I? While that which remains unseen or unrealized for an obvious reason symbolizes disembodiment itself, or who am I becoming? Our understanding of God, so to speak, is entirely absent of embodiment, and so the pathway toward becoming Him at the end of our evolutionary narrative remains hidden within the framework of disembodied symbolism, while the social veil is conversely conveyed through explicit and embodied images. Ego, or embodiment, is life, but God, or disembodiment, is the meaning of it. Therefore, meaning, as it occurs in our lives, is delivered in retrospect through realization and by way of disembodied but symbolic revelations. In life, we never see the tangible meaning of anything. We see what it is, but not why. What is the mother of evolution, and why is the father? That which is embodied can be defined, but that which is intuitive is only felt. So in both Psycho and Ed Gein's stories, the crisis point arrives when Norman and Ed find themselves confronted with the idea of their mothers becoming disembodied, as it precludes the universe of their childhood, so to speak, from continuing to exist, and thereby precludes embodiment from existing, which is a huge problem for them because, absent embodiment, the only thing you can become is the father. Their dilemma becomes one in which loyalty to the mother precludes becoming the father, which is basically the universe saying loyalty to ego or embodiment will preclude us from becoming the disembodied father. So nature places Ed, Norman, and even Leatherface in that predicament or dilemma, and makes them try to choose between ascending to become the father through disembodiment or remaining staunchly loyal to the ego or mother of embodiment. And what do all of them, both real and imagined, or fictional and non-fictional, proceed to do? Well, if disembodiment to become the father is an emotional endeavor, then how would you convey in images your undying loyalty to the mother, or ego, aka embodiment? Well, by digging up bodies from below the surface, which is a way of saying you're going to resurrect embodiment after it's already gone. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre starts with the report of a local grave robbery while showing the images of a skeleton removed from its grave and dressed as a man. It's a symbolic attempt to return the father to being a man because that allows embodiment. In our evolutionary narrative, as you often find in a church, the children sit and God, or the conduit to him, stands or has risen, so the skeleton here is seated on top of a gravestone, aka has risen and is suspended or ascended, but is in a sitting position still, saying it was manifested by a man-child. And soon after, we meet that man-child in the form of Leatherface. Norman Bates, of course, went to the cemetery and dug up his mother, bringing her body home and placing the clothed skeleton back inside the home. He symbolically places embodiment at the top of the hill and the motel, or transient place of change, as the abyss below him, falsely suggesting, as the grave in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre did, that ascension through embodiment has occurred. Here, we're told that message by Norman's mother appearing behind the window, which is the mirror universe or place of change, which has been rendered useless because she's dead. And so, the real place of change, the motel down below, what do we notice about it when we first introduced to it? It's empty. There's no change. So, in the film, when Norman goes down to the abyss, or motel, his mom actually never accompanies him, and instead, his ego urges him to feign being her as a means of false embodiment, essentially saying that the mother, or embodiment, returned. In Ed Gein's case, he robs one grave after another, impulsively bringing bodies to the surface over and over again, including his mother, in order to find purpose for them in a world in which embodiment is being extracted. As they no longer possess subjectivity in the form of being embodied autonomous life and are only objectively still embodied by that point, even if just as a clothed skeleton with some skin, what Ed Gein does is repurpose their embodiment from a perspective of subjectivity to one that indulges only objectivity instead. they are no longer subjects in death. They're merely objects, and therefore they have to be repurposed to accommodate their embodiment. In that light, Ed begins making household objects out of his mother's skin, and others he exhumes because their switch from subjectivity to objectivity renews not only their purpose for still being around, but validates their embodiment. These are things that stay in your home. You do not let go of them, you hold on, and so we have something called a household. A rotting corpse serves no purpose, but if you make a belt from someone's skin and it holds up your pants as you work all day, suddenly you have justified the reason for retaining that person in this world and done so simply by switching your perspective from one of subjectivity to objectivity. So Ed Gein is going to relentlessly repurpose those dead bodies headed for disembodiment in a manner that justifies embodiment in another form so that he can hold on to the past, literally and figuratively, which is exactly what we must completely avoid in the process of emotionally ascending to become the Father. But here it becomes corrupted by a physical solution. It's that simple. When Ed's mom died, she wasn't around the house any longer. He couldn't restore her subjectivity. But from a purely objective standpoint, he could bring her home, and like you do with the decor in your house, from the kitchen to the bath, utilize the emotional qualities inherent in a specific physical presence by using material that embodies the feeling you're looking to implore. Ed simply wants his mom to still be around after she dies, so by making her into furniture and similar, he can manipulate her objectivity into false subjectivity by having the objects he creates with her and others offer the physical equivalent of their emotional values. For instance, if having mom around brings you comfort, why not make her into a chair where you can sit and be comforted by her? That's the point. Ed is a handyman. When objects break down, he fixes them physically. He has absolutely no emotional capacity for doing the same emotionally, and so in times of necessary growth, he regresses. But here's the important part, at least in Ed's mind, as it relates to the images and how they're projected. If a person is disembodied in today's world, they're dead, and so rather than having disembodiment accompanied by the joy of becoming the Father, or disembodied white light, as it would be at the end of our successful evolutionary narrative, we have sadness instead. That sadness of losing those we love to embodied mortality is what drives us to seek a solution, such as AI, that will not only make us biologically immortal, but will alleviate the sadness associated with loss. Of course, it's still embodiment, but it's the next phase of our evolution toward disembodiment. Mortality must first become immortality, and the reason is that while death can drive the necessary change to immortality, once we're biologically immortal, then death is precluded from continuing to motivate us as it's obsolete. So when that happens, the movement toward becoming the disembodied Father follows because we understand that the universe is going to close or contract back to the singularity, aka disembody, and our only path to survival moving forward is to follow in the footsteps of that disembodiment by simply becoming information instead. So when Augusta Gein, Ed's mom, dies, all of his projections of her in the present, or perpetual now, that used to be projected onto the canvas of reality before his eyes, have all turned to memories of the past inside his head, meaning they only get projected onto his mind's eye. That means all of his associations with her will, from then on, be accompanied by sadness or loss, while he had always been used to the opposite, gain. A gift is also commonly called a present because the present is where things appear to us or are realized by us. We receive these gifts of the present over and over, and images merge to create a facade of movement. But if there is no present, meaning the person who appeared before your eyes died and is no longer there, then that gift of the present that just keeps on giving ceases to exist, and by extension, so does the movement. Emotionally, that leaves you feeling stuck, and the absence of that present or gift makes you yearn for it. So Ed, wanting to make his mother a part of the perpetual now, or present again, turns her into gifts that he gives to himself that disallow her body or embodiment from becoming irrelevant. By repurposing her, he's shortcutting his own emotional evolution, and specifically in the context of grieving. His mother did not prepare him for a world without her, and instead made him believe it was only worth living with her in it. Since he promised to never leave her, he exhumed the corpse, brought it home, and reintroduced her to his environment, newly embodied and repurposed as objects instead of a subject. Once there, he could again see her in the present or perpetual now, and that gift continued to give as the objects remained in the household and allowed him to alleviate sadness by projecting his dead mother onto the canvas of everyday life again with renewed purpose. She was a part of his world, of his home. But the most interesting aspect of it, as far as I'm concerned, is that once he makes her the object, or only objective, which is only embodiment, symbolically, it means he has to be the subject, or only subjective, absent embodiment, which of course makes him the father. So by objectifying or embodying her, by default he makes himself the subject, or disembodied, and in our evolutionary narrative, there is only one true subject, or self, in the end. The creator, or the father, or God, whatever you call it. So in the end, Ed considers himself having ascended to becoming the father by objectifying his mother and making himself the only subject alone in the house. Though we see how this manifested physical shortcut mirrors the intended result. Instead of becoming the disembodied father as God, he remains the embodied son. And that, of course, by structural definition, is the Antichrist. So instead of being like Christ and rising from the abyss to ascend through the conduit of the disembodied Holy Spirit to become God, Ed chooses to go down into the ground the opposite way and resurrect our embodiment. But you'll notice that there's no water for the cleansing there. It's the opposite. Dirt. So he rises. Instead of becoming disembodied and cleansed, he's embodied and covered in dirt, failing to resurrect mortality physically instead of extracting it through evolution emotionally. In the darkness of the mirror universe, down in the unconscious mind, or abyss, where we can't see below the surface, realization about who we're becoming rises disembodied through a conduit of emotional change leading to becoming reborn. So Ed manifests a physical shortcut by going down into the darkness where he can't see anything physically, creating physical change and causing the realization of who we used to be to rise instead, absent emotional rebirth. So he makes emotional rebirth physical repurposing instead, making the change happen objectively rather than subjectively. The abyss is the place inside ourselves where our future self is buried, unrealized, ready to be reborn. So Ed instead goes to the place outside where our past self is buried and never intended to rise. So we're going to go back to the beginning and see how his mother came to be the person who raised this innocent little child into a revolting monster. Now, as I've talked about in the past, we, as individuals participating in the same story known as history, are simply different perspectives of the same single identity. If you walk into a room, everything in there has been tailored to your individual experience in addition to the individual experiences of everyone else as well. You are the protagonist of your individual story and they of theirs, but each of us also plays a character in the other person's story. So, if you're writing a screenplay or a TV pilot, if you have characters with redundant perspectives, you eliminate them or combine them to disallow anything other than necessity to dictate how the story is told. What that means is that if something happens in your life today, it could very well be the manifestation of something, a seed, so to speak, that was planted long ago in another person's life, and nowhere are those examples more prevalent or even prominent than in familial lineage. We look at those who came before us in our genetic heritage, and the similarities, both emotional and physical, are apparent. And the reason we have genetics in the first place is that, in a world in which we're always becoming something other than what we currently are, something has to be the roadmap upon which we find the directions for reaching our goal. Now, the reason this is so important is that tracing behavioral factors through genetics in the context of familial lineage provides us with cyclical information rather than standalone anecdotes. For instance, if I know John Wayne Gacy is a serial killer, but don't know anything about his home life as a child in relation to his father, then my analytical accuracy only extends to the immediacy of placing labels upon the predator, such as psychopath. But within lineage, we find the binary function of father and son, or mother and son, that provides a direct link to the transcendence-related issue at hand. If a father is abusive toward a son, and the son becomes abusive as a father, we can identify an origin story or emotional mirror that precipitated the dysfunction. Too often, we examine these monsters in the context of what is wrong with them and them only, rather than considering how they're built and what they come from, and in doing so, limit our understanding in a manner that places the blame and origin solely upon the current offender. So let's not do that here. Let's not ask what's wrong with Ed Gein, but instead ask what genetic deficit in his family lineage leading up to his downfall created the man he became. And by genetic deficit, I don't mean psychological or physical disease, even though they are quite relevant. I'm talking about the story of our lives. As we evolve incrementally, we only incrementally disseminate an obvious truth that everything comprising our genetics isn't just what we look like and how we act. It's also the story itself. Like a movie, it has been long completed once you see it, but if you're watching it in the here and now, the only part you have access to is what appears before you on screen. just as happens on screen. You recall what's happened already inside your mind and then anticipate what's to come from a position of profound ignorance in darkness. And so our movie theaters are constructed like that as well. You sit in complete and total darkness in a universal womb as images are projected onto a screen to bring meaning. You and I, in society, think of a person's birth as the beginning of the story, but a person, upon being born, is simply manifesting the necessity of something emotional in the form of perspective that was long ago created and is only now being manifested out of necessity to kill it currently. Embodiment is a way of bringing emotional perspective on stage or into the story where you can kill it. Each person or perspective is another faulty or sinful aspect of the creator's ego that needs to be cleansed in order to evolve. The world, as you know it, is simply God's internal monologue afforded images in which the conflict can play out in physicality, rendering death to perspective. Slowly but surely, the seven sins, which are equivalent to the traditional seven Roy G. Biv colors on the color scale, are cleansed by way of the merger of all things, aka all colors, to become one, which, when you combine all those colors, of course, gives you the white light of God. All of which is to say that those colors are embodiment itself, that the opening and subsequent closing of the universe is the rendering of the color scale from one side in total darkness to the other in white light. So, when we examine a person, very little is understood by only looking at their experiences, yet the farther back we go in their genetic heritage or lineage, the more we're able to identify our lives as one continuous story. Those static images that constitute the story are afforded false movement by way of perception, specifically something called frequency. In the same way, animation uses one image followed by a slightly altered image thereafter, and so on, to facilitate movement on screen, that's what we are as well. You don't actually walk, drive, or fly anywhere. The idea of objects consuming space is ludicrous. Like happens in a video game or movie, it's all facilitated by way of perception on screen, which means that physical movement and by extension embodiment are lies. They can't exist as the construction dictates they must be afforded by a facade. Therefore, since physical evolution can only be a facade, by default of that truth, the only path to deification is emotional in the form of letting go. We must let go of all things embodied and presented to us in imagery as they are not real. They are lies and not the truth. But if you can build a facade that's a lie, then you can evolve to the truth by way of letting it go in the end. So that's what the concept of God becomes, because it is the only possible truth. Letting go of embodiment, because it is the one and only truth, meaning universal truth or singularity. So the thing you understand as life can only be facilitated by embodied ego fronted with lies that compete for perspective as truth. But since these are all impossibilities or lies, slowly but surely, we admit it by letting go. In your life, when you lose someone, meaning when their image disappears through disembodiment, the one thing you must do is let go of the image and move on. That's why the image goes from the screen in front of your eyes to the one behind it. Letting go is an internal, emotional endeavor. There can only be one perspective because there is literally only one truth. Anything else other than the white light that ever comes to be from the frequency of vibration, from sound to light to speech, is a fucking lie, and over time must be killed. So it is. We all go. That's the cleansing afforded by Christ in disembodiment. If you're not a criminal, you likely see yourself as a virtuous person, at least to a certain extent, and also honest, someone trustworthy, and certainly not a monster. But the truth is really so far from that fantastic reality that it's laughable. The ego makes you believe you are good and honest, but your existence itself is a lie. So, beneath that facade is the truth that you are born of things specifically designed to be killed because they are impure and comprised solely of lies. It's all lies. That's why, when you assert your truth, whether it's political, philosophical, or anything other than a structural roadmap leading to deification, it's a lie. When everything you experience must, by necessity, be facilitated through a facade to be believed, it means everything within, without any exception whatsoever, is a lie. It's not even possible to touch another person. A facade designed to create physical feelings related to touching their skin has to be applied as a cover-up that distracts you from the fact that electron forces disallow touch. If you sit in a chair, same goes. You aren't touching the chair. You are butting up against the force of oppositional electrons. So the image of the chair is combined with another facade that creates the feeling and the look of sitting. All of the science you know, and even the stuff you don't, is just horseshit because it can't be anything else. It's total nonsense, yet it is designed meticulously in order to facilitate a facade of truth. But by utilizing imagery derived from frequency of vibration, as you see in a movie in which things explode and science takes its course only by way of a facade, the same is true of our reality. Just look at how enormous the visual effects industry is. It's not so that we can tell the truth. It is so that we can tell lies. We put those lies on screen in favor of indulging their perception. Perception becomes reality. If you conduct a scientific experiment and it succeeds in providing truth, you have already precluded that truth as a lie because nothing can exist other than vibratory images presented in the context of an embodied facade. So in the end, it all goes, every fucking last bit, because it's all bullshit. It can't be anything else. It cannot be true. So, why does it exist? And more specifically, in this way? Well, it exists because, without this fantasy, there is nothing else. It was built this way because if everything is simply an image, then like your TV, which provides imagery and sequence to tell a moving story, it can be turned off when the story is over. Those images contract back to nothingness on the screen. And when you start the story over, boom, you have that big bang of the images out again. So I'll say it again. It was built this way because if everything is simply an image, then like your TV, which provides imagery and sequence to tell a moving story, it can be turned off when the story is over and restored to nothingness or darkness before starting all over again and again, never using anything other than projection to create a world so massive, magnificent, and wondrous that it seems downright impossible. Because it is. So, Ed Gein by refusing death of the mother or closing of the universe upon his mom's disembodiment, must do anything he can to continue to justify the ongoing facade of his mother's presence or embodiment in the perpetual now. So when she dies as an individual or human woman as his mother, he makes her embodied in the environment around him or his universe at home, the household, which also equates to being the mother collectively. As we, humanity collectively, are comprised of many perspectives instead of one body, when Ed repurposes Mom in that context, she goes from being embodied as an individual to being embodied collectively as objects. Everything comprising the mother, or universal womb, in the end, is designed to contract into one and disappear. So in resurrecting his mother, so to speak, Ed reverses that idea inside the universal womb of her home and makes her go from being an individual to becoming multiple objects. By preserving her embodiment, he preserves the existence of her universe or home, and so within we find a house of horrors in which many people have been repurposed from emotional subjects to physical objects. The more this act is indulged, the more it symbolically reverses the process of closing the universe due to disembodiment. So when we find Ed's mother's house full of objectified humans, so to speak, it tells us about a relentless and unwavering plight to increase embodiment and by extension manifesting this universe as opening and growing rather than closing and dying. Filling his universe with embodied objects instead of allowing them to disembody is a movement away from the father and toward the mother. It says becoming the father will never be achieved, and that's what his mother wanted. This is her will. Within, we clearly see Ed Gein's desires. If he doesn't become the father and his mother never disappears, those two can still remain together indefinitely in embodiment. Since it's actually a lie and must be repeated, just like every other image in the universe facilitating false movement, the behavior doesn't stop with his mother. He digs up more and more bodies headed for disembodiment. Now, if you did that a lot, what would we call it? Well, that measure of your desire to embody people as numbered by your repetitive actions would be defined in the same manner as all movement, with something called frequency. Frequency of vibration leading to sound, then light, literally creates the universe along the traditional color scale. It is embodiment itself. So the physical frequency with which Ed continues to dig up graves mirrors the emotional frequency or pitch of the vibrations causing his impulse. We see the same in the most violent serial killers as well. When their plight to manifest becoming the father in physicality through disembodying others fails, specifically because it's a physical shortcut to an emotional movement, the frequency with which they kill begins to rise drastically. The universe tries to tell you that you're going the wrong way on the color scale by releasing copious red blood with these deaths, as though it's saying, hey, you're stuck at the beginning of the scale on red. You can only reach the white light by emotional evolution leading to disembodiment. So every time you shortcut that growth by physically disembodying others instead of emotionally sacrificing your ego or old self, you only get blood and death. There's no transcendence, which means the movement must be repeated. And if the movement, which requires frequency, didn't work, then if you're incapable of an emotional solution, you'll increase physical frequency. the more frequency, the more noise and light and transparency, and by extension, the more embodiment. But instead of reaching universal truth by way of this increased frequency on an emotional level, what's created is simply more light related to embodiment, which means rather than evolving to universal truth or transparency emotionally, the higher frequency ultimately exposes the killer, and soon after, due to the greater light of embodiment he creates through that increased frequency, he's caught. So you'll notice with a lot of infamous serial killers that at the point that their frequency of killing gets out of control and they're killing people one after another, they get caught much more quickly and easily. But in order for frequency to rule the day, in the form of vibrations, it must be constructed so that the vibrations constituting your feelings are consistent with the images rendered or projected before your eyes. So, the killer lies to the universe and says, "Look at me, I'm evolving by killing embodiment, and watch me go. Now I'm doing it with greater frequency." Yet in truth, if this movement isn't emotional, it doesn't facilitate evolution. And the point is, of course, greater frequency takes a sound wave higher. So that's the point, ascension. Because in evolution, changing thoughts or feelings precipitate changing actions, which result in a different frequency to accommodate the change. So the killer, manifesting all of this in physicality, simply kills more often and says, "Hey, I'm changing a lot. The frequency is going up. I'm becoming the father through movement and disembodiment." But it's a lie. Changing frequency creates altered movement. So when the killer wants to manifest changing in order to become the father symbolically through movement, he simply changes the frequency with which he kills or disembodies victims. The higher the kill count and the faster and more intensely it happens in this logic, the closer you are to becoming the father, because that plight requires killing everything in the universe itself. That's also how we get the notion of down the hill. In the context of frequency, the highest pitch, or the perpetual now, is at the top, and the lowest at the bottom. So the killer places the embodied woman, dead, below on the hill where the frequency is lowest, and then he disappears from the top, disembodied. That's what frequency would do in a wave. Rise in pitch to a peak on one side and descend to death or nothingness on the other. So you stand at the top of the hill with the victim at the bottom, and then you disappear to symbolize the dead woman as the closed universe or mother, which would have no frequency or pitch any longer upon disembodiment, while you, having disembodied at the highest pitch at the top, just disappear. Frequency, in the Doppler effect, rises on the way up the hill, or climbs in pitch in the blue shifted light, and dies on the way down the hill in the red shifted light. So to manifest that structure, we get killers like Bridge Guy dressed in blue to show the father, aka highest frequency of blue shifted or new light, forcing the red shifted light of the girls, aka the embodied universe or universal womb, down the hill to their deaths or disembodiment below at the point of lowest frequency or no frequency in death at the bottom on the other side. They become the past in death. It's called the past because the location is literally past the point of highest frequency or pitch at the top of the hill in a sound wave. Okay, so I'm going to cut this first episode off here, as I just wanted to introduce some ideas and themes related to the psychology of the story we're going to examine moving forward. There are so many interesting, fascinating, and sickening events in Ed's life that we're going to break down moving forward, so I just wanted to get a lot of these ideas out of the way so that we could take a closer look at the events. In the next episode, let's go back to the past and examine Ed's parents, along with his difficult and strange childhood, for evidence of a continuing story about cyclical abuse, in which we can identify frequency precipitating his evil identity to come and leaving him reborn as the Butcher of Plainfield.